Oh, and we're back in the after dark.
It's after dark. It's after hours on Art of Darkness. This is Kevin bringing you that sweet, sweet Patreon ASMR.
Yeah.
What does ASMR stand for? Don't think too much about it.
Yeah.
Audio.
Automatic, sexy.
Sensory.
Oh, I thought it was sexy.
Maneuvering randomly. I don't know what it means. Yeah. That's okay. You don't have to think too much about it. I'm going to give you the mwah. Thank you so much, Patreon. Yeah. We appreciate it. We're back on the Dickinson After Dark. It's just Brad and me. We're real cozy. We're comfy.
Yeah.
We're in the pocket.
Yeah. That was a good episode. We were kind of just talking before we hit record about the dynamic of doing a Bukowski and then an Emily Dickinson episode, and something about the two extremes of the horseshoe theory of American poetry somehow. There is some Venn diagram between the two of them, and yet in another way they seem as far apart as possibly they can. And you know, Aldous Asterion has made this point, and it's, I agree with it. He's basically said American literature, he sort of makes this point, like, my biggest point of patriotism is American literature is like an embarrassment of riches. And when you see somebody like Bukowski and then Emily Dickinson, you're like, yeah, you're right. Like, this thing we're in is all over the friggin' map, man.
I do often struggle with this idea that, like, if America is a net, ultimately becomes a net evil in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of people think it is. I don't.
There's an argument.
I have to live in it. So I don't, you know, we are producing some pretty amazing art.
Mm-hmm,
and
for sure.
Letters. I don't know what we're
and have done so for generations.
Yeah. There's something about, okay. All right. Well, anyway, we operate with a chip on our shoulder because we're in the middle of nowhere.
Well, that's true too.
Yeah, we're outside of history. Yeah, we're the bastard children of history.
We play angry kind of, which has interesting results. Yeah.
At every level, man. I mean, you know, and I was thinking about this because I started, we do play angry. I was reading Ham on Rye again after the Bukowski episode and just remembering just how mean kids are, how brutal everything is. And then I was watching one of these anonymous accounts, you know, was talking about how some German girl, I think, came over and it might have been a boy, I don't know, some German kid came over. And when they found out they were German, it was all in the public school. It was all just World War II, Nazi, Hitler, Joe, you know, and all of these American Anons were like, it's been X number of years, learn how to talk shit.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to make of that. Because I saw it from all angles, you know, because the poor German kid's like, we don't talk about it.
Right.
The Americans are like, I'm tickling your jewels a little bit. I'm giving you a little bit of
stress testing you.
Yeah.
Stress testing you a little bit.
That is part of the American character, isn't it? It's not uniquely American. I think
it's somewhat a human universal,
but bust balls, but
yeah. I mean, we did, but you know, we did invent battle rap in the United States as a which it was actually an old tradition amongst the old oral poets of like ancient Greece, but we brought it back to the fore.
It's a very very competitive culture, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But don't, you know what, Brad, I mean, it's just like the Beatles, sometimes somebody finds their John, sometimes somebody finds their Paul.
Yeah.
And in our case, sometimes somebody, like, I'm John and you're Yoko. Damn it. Oh, man. Yeah, I'm just giving you shit, dude. Got a little meta there, didn't it?
That did. That's funny. As promised, we're going to talk about two aspects of Emily Dickinson that are somewhat murky.
I'm excited now, for this. That was a good episode, dude. I really am jacked to read these poems too. And of course, everybody here, you're on Patreon. Yeah. You're going to get access to the book club. I hope you join us on the day. I don't know what kind of turnout we're going to get for this, but I think hopefully based on that core episode, if you weren't sold already, you're now sold on Emily.
I think so.
And
let me tell you, like, you listen to that episode and read those poems. And I'm not embarrassed to admit, I mean, that's like several weeks of a college class right there, I think, in terms of learning American literature.
Yeah, just the pure download. Poetry.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, right. And also history and the adjacent. Mm-hmm. We could do 10 episodes on Dickinson and the surround. Oh, yeah. We could do an entire podcast about it. Yeah, dude. No,
all the historical implications.
Yeah, and with my degree and everything, if I really wanted to, like, if we really wanted to go hard, that would be a different show, though. That's not this show.
No.
But yeah, hopefully you appreciate how this isn't a tightly plotted 45-minute bells and whistles NPR profile. It's something else.
It's because to some degree, we're making theater, Kevin.
We are.
Yeah.
We're putting on a show.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the two things we're going to talk about is Emily Dickinson's sexuality. And again, not trying to scandalize this and find some salacious details. I want to look at how this has been examined and perhaps in some ways exploited. And then we're going to do a kind of a similar thing about what illnesses might have affected her. But we're going to start with the sexuality thing. So partially why I wanted to do this in the Patreon room is I found myself a little irked with how Emily Dickinson has been used. There's a certain extent to which she's been leveraged for identity politics purposes, as there's this intimation that she may have had a lesbian relationship. So I've seen people promote her for like Pride Month or something. And it's not just that bothers me necessarily, but I'm doing this research and I'm becoming intoxicated with a peculiar genius who is changing my notion of what creativity is. And the only chatter I see about her on the internet is, hey, she's a lesbian. Ain't that nice? And it's like, she's an entire human being. Like,
right. Even if there was a daguerreotype,
right? Yeah,
of her in the act,
right,
holding a pair of scissors in her hands,
right? Yeah,
letting you know unequivocally that she was in fact a lesbian and would be on board with your program today,
right? Right.
Even then, Even then, that's one fragment. Right. Microscopic fragment of who she was.
Mm-hmm. And this is maybe what frustrates me, and maybe it's helping me understand what really upsets me about identity politics is you're reducing everyone to just these identities.
You're grafting on, it's narcissism at that
point. You're turning,
and this is narcissistic. And we had a little pre-show talk about this too.
Yeah.
You could equally be celebrating Brando. Brando's a little closer, and Brando's also big dirty. Brando's also a motherfucking monster.
Right, exactly.
Emily's nice and safe because she sat in her room.
Right.
And
if you, as long as you don't read the poetry or read the scholarship, Emily is enough of a mystery that you can do whatever you want with her.
Yeah, that's evil.
Right. And so when we see a show like Wild Nights with Emily, I'm not, in theory, 100% against it. And Wild Nights with Emily sort of is a fictionalized version of Emily Dickinson's relationship with Susan Gilbert, as we discussed in the main episode. I'm not entirely against it, but I don't like the notion that what we're going to do is take a great American writer that the average millennial Zoomer knows nothing about, and the first story we're going to tell about her is a fictionalization of her wild homosexual life.
Kind of gross.
But you don't know anything about her except that, which is made up.
It's kind of exploitative, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit, right?
It's a little bit exploitative.
Yeah.
You see that a lot these days, don't you?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. How would you feel if your letters and you're writing 200 years hence, let's say X number of years hence, were taken by some group and repurposed for political ends,
right?
You'd feel a little, who knows how you'd feel, right? Maybe you're all on board, you're entirely on board with this, but it feels a little, it's a little cringe.
Yes, agreed, 100% agreed. Now, so we've made our comments about it. Let's talk a little bit about the evidence for whether this was relationship was a sexual nature.
And good for her if it was.
Oh yeah, and this is the thing. Tremendous. This is why I wanted to walk delicately. Yeah. I don't care all that much one way or the other what her orientation would have been. I feel bad because I've sort of fallen in love with her in a certain way, right?
Yeah.
I feel bad if she lived a disappointed life. I do feel bad about that. So whatever she wanted, I would like to know that she got it. But let's see what we've got. So there's been a lot of ink spilled about this, which I think makes sense. We talked about how Mabel Loomis Todd, who was not only Emily's brother's mistress, but you know, which is funny because if Emily and Susan Gilbert were in a relationship, she was her sister. She was her own sister-in-law's mistress. And then both Austin and Susan Gilbert had a mistress. Just interesting, kind of.
But you lost me. I have no idea what you're talking about. I can't follow.
It's complicated.
She
is her own grandpa in some way.
Yeah, something like that.
Mabel, we talked briefly of Mabel Loomis Todd, who was sort of who was a primary driver for getting Emily Dickinson's poems published, along with Vinnie Dickinson and Thomas Wentworth Higginson. Mabel Loomis Todd, being Austin's mistress, Austin Dickinson's mistress, wouldn't have wanted Susan Gilbert to be acknowledged in the Dickinson lore, and so made an active effort to sort of erase her from the record. Now, there have been people who've taken the letters and said this is clear proof, but there's also been people who've done a deeper dive into Emily Dickinson's poetry itself, looking for clues that might hint to us a deeper sense of Emily's sexuality. In particular, there's a thesis by a woman named Dorothy Lynn Lockridge called A Study in the Sexuality of Emily Dickinson, who uses the work of another scholar named Rebecca Pattinson. And I'm going to just kind of read a little bit of this. I'll read a poem that is cited as one of their primary indications that Emily Dickinson had sexual and romantic interests in women. Ourselves were wed one summer, dear. Your vision was in June. And when your little lifetime failed, I wearied too of mine. And overtaken in the dark where you had put me down by someone carrying a light, I too received the sign. 'Tis true our futures different lay, your cottage faced the sun, while oceans in the north must be on every side of mine. 'Tis true your garden led the bloom, for mine in frosts were sown, and yet one summer we were queens, but you were crowned in June. Okay. The two persons, and then the essay goes on, the thesis goes on, the two persons who were wed one summer, according to the first line of the poem, are identified as queens in the next to last line. I don't know. Is that Emily posing? Is that her playing out some kind of archetypal character? Is queens mean something else? It's a little hard to pin a whole heck of a lot on that one poem out of 1700 some odd poems. There is now, there's a few poems, and you could find this thesis if you want. I think it's called The Spider and the The Spider and the Whale, The Spider and the Something, about, and it, she digs into a number of these Emily Dickinson poems. I can probably find another one. I thought I had copied and pasted this, but I apparently had not. Let me find it real quick. I got so many tabs open, Kevin. Okay. let me find this other poem, which is an interesting poem in and of itself, because it uses a word that is very evocative, but has a totally different meaning than it used to.
The spider and the flower? Is that
spider
it?
And the flower, yes.
Yeah. The spider and the whale, that doesn't seem like a fair match.
No, it doesn't. And there's
a very different
whale.
weight class.
Right. Right.
And in this corner, we have the eight-legged wonder, the arachnid from Atlanta, Mr. Spup. Whale.
Yeah. Just land on him. Done. It's over.
Landed on the announcer too.
Yeah. Where's this
whale?
Where is this poem?
the undisputed champion, the whale.
Am I not gonna find this?
Find the poem. I can only vamp for so long, Brad.
I know.
You got it.
Well, I guess. Shoot, what the heck? I can't word search on this thing because it's a scan. Is the problem? Thought I had copied it out, but I apparently didn't. Well,
what poem were you looking for? The spider and the
That's the name of the thesis. There's a poem that includes the line has the word sperm in it, but it actually refers to whale oil as used in a lamp. Oh yeah, you probably can just search for it, huh?
Yeah. Huh.
Let's see. Her face was a bed of hair. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Her face was in a bed of hair like flowers in a plot. Her hand was whiter than the sperm that feeds the sacred light. Her tongue more tender than the tune that totters in the leaves. Who hears may be incredulous. Who witnesses believes. Now, the word sperm is oil in a lamp that you would use. Sperm whale oil. It's not sperm like we're talking about. But there is sexual innuendo here. This idea, her tongue more tender than the tune that totters in the leaves. And Emily Dickinson had used flowers almost indisputably at times as sexual imagery, right?
Yeah, but isn't this reminiscent of Ophelia too?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think
you're right. And Emily Dickinson was obsessed with Shakespeare. So she knew the story of Ophelia.
It's like a little poem for Ophelia too.
Yeah. So that's the thing, is I think because these poems are such prisms, you can start to read them any way you want. And I'm not even dismissing this analysis of this poem as being indicative of homosexual sexuality, but I don't think it's a clear-cut case. Now, here is another piece of evidence that I came across, and this one is, well, you tell me how valid you think this is. Okay, so where the heck is it? So many tabs on the website.
This is crazy. You can go to Wikisource and you can get all of her poems in order.
Yep.
One. Here's a random one.
Yeah.
1719.
Yeah.
God is indeed a jealous God. He cannot bear to see that we had rather not with him, but with each other play.
Right. Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm just like
1700 yikes. Of them in there. Yeah.
And that's more than a poem. That's right. Aphoristic. That's it philosophical. Is. It's wild. Anyway, go on.
It's everything. Yeah, she's doing all these things. There's and I'm not going to say that they're all just as good as the other. You know, some are clearly better than others, but geez, she's up to something in every single one of them.
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what? I came across this article on gaiety.com, which is apparently a website, a journalistic website about various issues and news items related to the LGBTQ community. And they discuss with great fervor a daguerreotype that emerged sometime in the last 20 years, a second daguerreotype of Emily Dickinson. This one shows her sitting next to somebody named Kate Scott Turner, better known as Kate Anton. This was someone who was a friend of hers. And Emily would have been about 30 when it was taken. Yeah, because it came out in 1859. So she's about 30. And it's true that Emily Dickinson sent poems to Kate and knitted her garters at one point. This article goes on to say that Kate Scott Turner, Kate Anton, moved to Europe. And here's the part that I can't substantiate. She moved to Europe and then lived the rest of her life openly gay, despite being married to a man until 1874. I cannot substantiate this. I can't find it anywhere but this one website article. And they make a big deal of the fact that she took a photo with a woman who later they claim turned out to be homosexual.
Yeah.
And it's kind of held up as the, like, is this the thing? Is this it? Does this nail it? I don't think, again, that doesn't necessarily seal the deal for me. I think, I guess coming at the end of this thing is, I think there's pretty decent evidence that Emily Dickinson was in love with her neighbor and her sister-in-law, Susan Gilbert. I don't know how much more
maybe
you can say
about
that.
She was bisexual.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
She seemed to be a world appreciator. She seemed to be somebody who could have deep, strong feelings for many different things. Agreed. So I would not be surprised if she was capable of loving another woman, and even possibly in a sexual way. Gasp.
Right. That,
right.
Yeah. So she's not. Yeah. Okay.
Now I have to go back and reread everything she wrote in that light.
Through that lens, apparently. All the time. Constantly.
All the time. That's the only thing that matters. Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. You get why I wanted to talk more.
No,
about
I'm glad you did. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Now, here's the other thing. So, okay. She had mentioned many, many times in her writing, and certainly was actually ill and would mention being ill, and often talks about things, phenomena occurring in her brain, which seemed physiological. So there was much speculation for a long time about what was the nature of this quote unquote illness. Most recently, the scholar Lyndall Gordon, in her biography, Lives Like Loaded Guns — I did not read this book, by the way, but I've read little bits of it — Lives Like Loaded Guns, a book about Emily Dickinson and the people around her, she makes the claim that Emily Dickinson had epilepsy. Now, we'll kind of make Lyndall's case, or Lyndall Gordon's case, and then we'll explain some of the scholarship that's been done after that that kind of counters it. So Lyndall Gordon says a couple things. One thing to set up about epilepsy: there is a sense that epilepsy had a social stigma, especially at this time. Prior to Emily Dickinson's era, it had even been associated with witchcraft. Like, you're having some uncontrollable seizure and saying crazy heteroglossia things, you know, you're a witch. In Emily Dickinson's time, it was something more like you might be confined to an asylum if you had epilepsy. Right. The sense that you could just randomly lose control of bodily functions, I think, was very disturbing when it had no explanation. Right. When Emily spent two terms at Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, she ended up having to go home with an illness, and she never went back. So this is one of Lyndall Gordon's arguments. She apparently liked being in school. Why would she just quit completely? If there is this steep social stigma, it might also explain why she confined herself to the home all the time, and why the rest of her family was fine with accommodating that, right? It's like, if you're her father, you're like, well, I mean, I don't want her to go to an asylum, so we'll just try to make life as comfortable as we can for her here. Mm-hmm. And you can see how you might arrive at that. That might make sense. And you can see, you know, you can't go out because you could have a seizure at any moment. You don't know when they're going to happen. So you can't take that risk. Lyndall Gordon also said in her book that Emily Dickinson took glycerine for a number of years, and that glycerine was this treatment, proved to not be effective, but it was for a long time used as a treatment for epilepsy. And it was used as a treatment for other things. And so Emily was taking this under the cover of taking it for one reason. She was actually taking it for having epilepsy. Linda Gordon also claims that when Emily went to Boston to be treated by an ophthalmologist for several months, that really what was going on is her epileptic seizures were causing temporary and partial blindness, and they were trying to figure out a way to work around that. Okay. Then, okay, so maybe that's the case. There is, and I'm going to read you two little poems that kind of square pretty well with the epilepsy thing. Okay, here's one. I don't know the number. I felt a cleaving in my mind as if my brain had split. I tried to match it seam by seam, but could not make it fit. The thought behind I strove to join unto the thought before, but sequence raveled out of sound like balls upon a floor. It's quite nice. Okay, Here's another one. This is a number 1277. While we were fearing it, it came, but came with less of fear because that fearing it so long had almost made it fair. There is a fitting, a dismay, a fitting, a despair. 'Tis harder knowing it is due than knowing it is here. They trying on the utmost, the morning it is new, is terrible than terribler than wearing it a whole existence through. Now, in particular, there's lines there. There is a fitting, a dismay, a fitting, a despair. When back in the day, back in her day, if you were epileptic and you had a seizure, they didn't call it a seizure. They called it a fit. You had a fit. Now, Lyndall Gordon also makes the claim that at least two people that Emily Dickinson were related to had epilepsy, a sort of uncle, a distant uncle, and her nephew. Okay, so building this case quite well until... Also, Emily Dickinson had a bunch of poems about volcanoes, which if you know, epileptic seizures do kind of build up. And if they're stress induced in particular, you can kind of feel them working up until you have them. Right. There is a kind of a volcanic aspect to that. But OK. In 2013, a few years after this biography came out, to much less acclaim and attention than Lyndall Gordon, two doctors, Norbert Hertshorn and Polly Longsworth, published an article in a John Hopkins publication called Perspectives in Biology Medicine, spending quite a bit of time and energy on investigating the claim that Emily had epilepsy. And what I want to point to is how much ink has been spilled in trying to figure this woman out, right? It's you have doctors writing in a medical journal trying to diagnose her. They basically refute every single one of Emily's, of Lyndall Gordon's claims. They say that the reason she was pulled out of school, it squares with the fact that she complained of a cough and that she complained, and that she was losing weight, that she probably was, had tuberculosis when she was about 18 years old. And that this would have required bed rest to some extent. They claim that glycerine, there's no evidence that anybody ever used glycerine to treat epilepsy, and that this is a misreading by Lyndall Gordon. One of Emily Dickinson's most acclaimed biographers has misread the medical literature. Nobody was ever using this. And there's also no evidence that she took another medication for epilepsy, chloral hydrate. They claim that it's pretty clear from ophthalmological practices at the time that she had iritis of the eye. She had an inflammation of the eye that had to be treated and eventually went away kind of on its own. And they cite the fact that they think she had tuberculosis when she was young and suffered from anxiety attacks later in life. And there's one little bit, there's one little bit from a letter that I just want to read that sounds like it could have been an anxiety attack. And that's what these doctors, Hertshorn and Longsworth, say. This is from Dickinson writing to, I believe, I'm not sure who she was writing to a cousin, one of the Norcross cousins. Quote, "The nights turned hot when Vinny had gone, and I must keep no window raised for fear of prowling booger," which I don't know what that means, a burglar. "And I must shut my door for fear front door slide open on me at the dead of night. And I must keep gas burning to light the danger up. This gives me a snarl in the brain, which does not unravel yet." Okay. So, yeah, so they, interestingly enough, these doctors, I mentioned in the main episode, Emily Dickinson died of Bright's disease. And we said that Bright's disease is really, it's really something they didn't quite understand at the time. And it's actually could be a bunch of different things. They dug deeper into what little medical history was known. They even found pharmacy records, Amherst pharmacy records for different drugs that the Dickinsons bought, whether for Emily or for anybody else. And they came to the conclusion, right, 100 and almost 200 years after Emily Dickinson's life, they diagnosed her with accelerated hypertension, which in the 1880s wasn't understood as a separate entity. It would have just been thought of as a symptom of something else. And they believe that accelerated hypertension killed her. Okay. Is this at all interesting? I don't know. But what I do find interesting is how intensely people even now are poring over the fragments of evidence to try and figure out who this woman was. What a mystery she left behind for us. Yeah.
A riddle in a riddle. And the poems are little puzzles and little trinkets. And then
that's what you almost wonder too, is like, did she seclude herself? Is that the part of the art too? Like, where does the art stop? Right? Is it all some kind of act? I don't know. Very interesting. Yeah. Well, that's all I got.
Thank you for your support, Patreon. We're not going to stop that. We appreciate it, Brad. Banger. All right. Great work.
Thanks.